If you had asked me last Sunday what the worst news out of the state of West Virginia was, I would have told you it was West Virginia University's basketball team's loss, one game short of a national championship in the Final Four March Madness NCAA tournament in Indianapolis. The news out of my home state over the past several days has demonstrated the difference between a mere disappointment, like losing a basketball game, and a real horrible tragedy like a coal mine explosion that takes the lives of 29 miners and leaves a closely knit community in a state of deep shock and deep grief. While coal is not the only source of electrical power in our country, the fact remains that whenever we turn on a light or use any of the other electrical appliances that we do in our daily lives, we are asking young and sometimes not so young men, and it's mostly men, to risk their lives and the well-beings of their families on a daily basis. Among the news feeds that are still coming out of that little grief-stricken town, which is about 30 miles south of the town in which I was raised, are those that focus on the faith, on the religious convictions of its inhabitants. There are signs all over the place asking for prayers for the miners and their families, and now for the souls of those who have lost their lives. Prayer meetings take place in what are generally small white clapboard churches, churches that are now also the sites for many of the funerals that will be held. Even as I know that not everyone in these small Appalachian communities believes in the same way, by and large, in these gatherings, a loving and merciful God will be praised, a God whose ways are not always understood, but a God in whom one must have faith and trust, nonetheless, that he, and it's still by and large a he will care for you and sustain you, just as his son Jesus cared about people like you and for whom he gave his life. This may no longer be the faith that I affirm, but for me to watch the stories that continue to come out of Montcoal, West Virginia, is to be reminded where my own religious and spiritual journey began. While I did not grow up in a coal mining town, I still swam in the that larger religious culture for about the first 20 years or so of my life. Earlier in our service, we welcomed new members, which is always a joy. Each person who joins our congregation also represents a journey that they bring with them. Some of those journeys, and Bruce alluded to this, involve in a way similar, not necessarily identical, but in a way similar to mine, moving away from a faith tradition, from one set of religious beliefs and practices, which may no longer speak meaningfully to that person, and looking to move in some other directions instead. Others who join with us may not be coming from any strong religious background at all as a part of their personal history, but still find themselves on a search for some greater levels of meaning and depth in their lives. And they're looking for a community where they can be supported in that search. And they're also usually looking for people they can just simply enjoy being with. I hope and believe we are all of those things. For many years, I've made it a practice, along with our membership coordinator, as Sherry has been for many years now, to have a conversation with each person before they put their name on our membership book. I like to learn a little bit about the individual, each of those journeys that have brought them to this point. And as I think on those conversations and do a little re-reflecting on some of my own journey, I find some confirmation for what Dr. Harvey Cox has written in his latest book, The Future of Faith, where he says that we, and he means we in a very broad cultural sense here, we are moving from what he calls an age of belief to an age of the Spirit. This is the third, and I promise you, the final sermon in a series that I'm doing that was generated by Dr. Cox's book, which I read sometime back before Christmas. I've already done two of them in January, so I'm only going to give a very brief flyby to Dr. Cox today. I really have pretty much done what I needed to do with him, or what I wanted to do with him in those other sermons. His broad-based prediction as a now 80-year-old lifelong observer and scholar of religion in the West, he just retired from a professorship at Harvard, he says that for now, many religion now is, and will be, less a matter of finding a codified set of beliefs to which one can subscribe, and more a matter of seeking out in an eclectic kind of a way those ideas, beliefs, practices, and those faith-based communities whereby and wherein one can feel some connection with a reality greater than themselves, with some larger spirit of life, where they can find ways, in the words of the late Forest Church, to say yes to the cosmos, ways that go beyond, as I say, codified belief. And Harvey Cox, as you may remember from one of the sermons I did also, he sees fundamentalism as a kind of a rearguard action against this larger trend. I happen to think it's a little more than that, but I've already devoted one sermon to that, and I'm going to leave it. And this is really as far as I'm going to go with Harvey today, other than to say as a segue that this latest book of his, like I said, just came out last fall. This latest book of his reminded me of another somewhat similar one that came out a good 30 years ago by a Dr. James Fowler, which was called Stages of Faith. That's the one I'm going to use for a bit this morning as I explore this topic of a mature spirituality. Dr. Fowler had recently retired as a professor of theology at Emory University, but he didn't start out in the religious field, didn't start out as a religious guy. Originally, he was, well, he still is, a developmental psychologist, and he became a very active lay leader in the United Methodist Church. So he had his feet in two places, his foot in academia, and then he was also a very involved lay leader in a liberal Protestant Christian denomination. And he began to put those two things together, and he became interested in how people's ideas and beliefs about religion and spirituality develop and change over the human life cycle. So he took some of these human development categories and stages that psychologists like to talk about, and he applied them to faith development, to spiritual development. And he got, depending upon how you count them, either six or seven such stages. Now, the good Dr. Fowler, being the good academic that he was and is, could not resist giving these stages of faith good academic-sounding names. So he came up with titles for them like intuitive, projective, and mythic liberal, literal, and synthetic, conventional, and individuative, reflective, stuff like that. All due respect to him, I figure even as bright a bunch of folks as you are probably not going to remember, much less process that kind of jargon, and I know that I can. Besides all that, as I went to work on this sermon, I discovered that my word processing program doesn't even recognize a word like individuative. It was... Every time I put it in, this red line popped up right underneath it. So I figured I got to go back to my own drawing board here and come up with some brand new, easy to grasp names for these stages that we can all relate to. And I actually spent some time thinking about it, and I did that, and I came up with these names. They are stages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10. Easy enough. All right. Let's roll here. Stage 1. I actually understand this, but it's called stage 1 primal. Simple enough. It's when an infant first begins to sense. And if you ever raised a kid, remember this probably. It's when an infant first begins to sense in a pre-verbal, sometimes even pre-cognitive kind of a way, his or her environment. It's when the infant begins to sense that there is, you know, there's a me here and there's some kind of an other out there. And even in that early stage, they find themselves, you know, asking at whatever level infants think, is that other a safe and accepting one, or is it a threatening and a mistrustful one? And those earliest sensations do play a role in how a person will relate to his or her world at later points in their life. Stage 2 usually runs from late infancy, 3 or 4, to about age 7. This is where you begin to learn a language. And you begin to hear stories. And with respect to those stories at this age, there's very little differentiation between what's fantasy and what's not. You begin to hear the beginnings of a narrative that you will later fit into. These narratives are not just religion. They can be your family stories, you know, when your great-grandparents came over on the boat. They can be cultural stories when you hear about the history of the country or the culture that you're growing up in. All part of a narrative that you're going to later fit your life into. And one's first ideas about God are usually formed here, which is often an expanded version of one's parents. If you have loving and caring parents, then God is this greater, super-loving, caring person who lives off in some other place. In a home where Christmas is celebrated, you know, God and Santa Claus can sometimes kind of get all mixed in together there. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. That could be God or Santa Claus. In a religious community, this is where then you first began, as I say, hearing the stories of that faith. Again, with no distinction between what's fantasy and what's not. Stage three is when you begin to think about the meaning or the possible meanings behind these stories or the pictures of God that you're being given. The stories are still taken literally, but you start to think about, well, what does this mean about my life? So they're not just stories. They got something to do with me. This kind of morphs into stage four. We're up to early adolescence now, which is where you begin to form a belief system, some conceptual way of understanding and relating to your world based upon the stories and the teachings and the God concepts you've been exposed to up to this point. You may be getting away from some of the literal pieces of those stories, but they're still very vocal stories. You take them seriously. And this is the point at which most religions have, for very good reason, because it's this stage, this is when most religions have their coming-of-age rituals. Their bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, confirmation classes. We call it ropes here, ropes of passage experiences. Then you get to stage five, which is where this individuative stuff comes in. Also could be called the demythologizing stage or the critical thinking stage. Later adolescence, moving towards early adulthood. Here it's like, okay, wait a minute. Is all that really true? All that stuff really happened? Who or what is God anyway? Or does such a person even happen to exist? The bigger picture of what's happening here is that one is forming an independent identity for oneself based on a sense of who you think you are on your own terms. That's what individuative means. I can't seem to get away from that word, even though it knocked me for a loop the first time I saw it. Now, this identity, it's going to build on it, maybe incorporate some of what you've learned up to this point, but it also could be based on, very often is, built on a certain amount of rejection, clearing the decks of all you've been inculcated with, so you can then begin to figure out who the real you is. This stage involves deciding what you're going to reject and what you're going to keep, what might and might not work for you. You work through that, you get to stage six, maybe, which could be called the remythologizing stage. Okay, you think? So a lot of those stories weren't really true in any historical sense, but perhaps they have some deeper metaphorical value, after all, I can relate to. Okay, so I no longer believe in God as a supreme being of a supernatural sort, but perhaps I am a part of some greater mystery, some greater reality that I cannot and probably will not ever fully grasp, but I still want to pursue a relationship with this greater mystery, whatever it may be. A person working his or her way through this stage may well come to appreciate some words by the late Forrest Church when he once wrote, "When people tell me proudly they do not believe in God, I ask them to tell me a little about the kind of God they don't believe in, for I probably don't believe in that God either." And Forrest goes on, "God is not God's name. God is our name, for that which is greater than all and present in each. Call it what you will, spirit, ground of being, being itself." So this is where you come to appreciate irony and paradox. And this is where you begin to see that your story, your narrative, your philosophy, your life stance that you take from that narrative is but one of many in this world. You learn to value and appreciate the stories, the narratives, the philosophies, the faiths of others. This is the point which I consider to be, using my sermon title, a mature spirituality. But wait, there's more. Stage seven. Fowler uses language for this one I can actually get. He calls this the universalizing stage. He says it's one that is generally reserved for mystics and seers, for those who get beyond intellectualizing about the oneness of all things and actually feel like they are participating in it on an ongoing basis. According to Fowler, this stage also includes the Mother Teresa's, the Martin Luther King's, and those whose faith is integrated with an unswerving commitment and devotion that cannot be hindered or quenched. Well, okay, I guess that's all well and good. But let's try to make it, if we can do so, a little less academic. I thought about this and I said, well, look, we just had this, we celebrated a Seder here about a week ago this past Friday. How about we take that Seder story and run it through these stages and see where it gets us. So, if you read that story, the story that's told at every Passover, everywhere, every time Passover is ever celebrated, You take that story and you run it at any point up to stage 3 and maybe with a little bit of wriggle room into stage 4, and you tend to see it the way Cecil B. DeMille told it in the Ten Commandments there. You know, I mean, that Red Sea just opened right up when Moses held the staff up there and those 12 tribes of Israel were marching right through there, and wham, it came back again and Pharaoh's army got drowned. And a little later, the hand of God wrote those Ten Commandments on those slabs of rock, and that's why we're supposed to obey them. And at the end of the story, God carried Moses off to heaven after allowing him to see the promised land from the top of the mountain where he died. And that is a great story, and it sure made one heck of a movie that ran for about 4 hours. And I still watch that thing when it comes out on the, they always show it, you know, like sometime leading up to Easter. I still sit there and watch the whole thing. Well, stage 5 comes along and says, okay, come on, get real here. That whole business about the 12 tribes was written up by the court scribes during the reign of King David when he was trying to unify these nomadic people into a single kingdom. And this story about how the progenitors of each of our tribes were all brothers kind of did the trick. See, we were all related way back there when, sometime. And as David further realized, since Egypt does pose a threat to our southern border, let's get it out there about how they once enslaved their ancestors, so we still got to keep an eye on them. You see, it's all a mythical story based on a slave revolt that probably happened, but certainly not the way it got told in the book of Exodus. And those Ten Commandments are generally reflective of the moral codes at that time all over the ancient Near East. Had nothing to do with the hand of a deity, so grow up. Stage 6er comes along, says, well, yeah, okay, everything you said is correct, but there's a deeper and a very real human story going on here about the human struggle always and ever to overcome bondage and oppression and to move on to greater levels of freedom. And we can still relate to that story on that level because that's part of a greater human story. And it's also about people who felt that their lives were bound up with and in something greater than themselves, and the best name they had for it was Yahweh, so that's what they went with. And we may not use that term, but we still look for some greater dimension, some deeper meaning in our lives, whether we invoke the name of a deity or not, or whatever name we may have for it. And whatever the origins of those Ten Commandments were, many of them do point to moral codes that human beings have to live by, that we still live by. So we can still appreciate this story for its universal value. We can appreciate it for its metaphorical value. And by golly, you can just grow up. So that conversation goes on. Stage 7 person doesn't even get into that conversation. They're somewhere beyond it. And really, when I think of this story, this Passover story at the stage 7 level, I think of the concluding words to the last public speech that Martin Luther King made the night before he was killed. He said to his audience there in Memphis, I have been to the mountaintop, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I have seen the promised land. Now, Moses was a mythical figure. Dr. King had a PhD in religious studies from Boston University, so he surely knew that. But that didn't stop him from channeling Moses the night before he lost his own life. For Dr. King was a universalistic type of visionary who was able to take a tribal legend and turn it into a universal narrative, which in turn turned a whole nation around. That's stage 7 stuff. Okay, that's that. I want to offer one quick caveat before I wrap this up. As I put these thoughts together, I found I was becoming a little uneasy with my sermon title, that mature spirituality. I didn't want to really come off in any arrogant kind of a way by saying that persons at one stage are somehow more spiritually mature and more spiritually advanced than those at another. I don't really mean that. In that initial religious climate of mind that I spoke about when I began these remarks, I saw people there, lived with people there, grew up with people there who, like, say, well, my father, were very well grounded, were very much at peace with what Fowler calls the mythic literal stage. They felt no need to be anywhere else. And I cannot, in all honesty, call that immature. It just doesn't happen to be where I am now. And I'll admit I do get a little impatient sometimes with persons at that stage 5, that kind of redefining, reassessing kind of a thing. who are demythologizing and rejecting and doing a lot of casting off, which is where people like Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, seem to be. But I finally have to say, all right, if this is where you need to be, then be there for as long as you have to, even if it takes up a good piece of your life. And in addition to all that, I have seen, I've worked with people at differing ones of these stages, whose commitment to working for a more sane, peaceful, just, and humane world is at least as strong as mine, and in many cases more so. Fowler himself doesn't make value judgments about who should be at which stage, and I try to avoid doing that myself. So when I say that I feel pretty well settled in at stage 6, that re-mythologizing one, I'm only pointing to where my journey has brought me at this 7th decade of my life. To conclude, we here are a community of journeys. We're a community of journey makers. This is the kind of congregation to which we welcome new members, even as we affirm and celebrate the paths of those who have long been with us. Our third Unitarian Universalist principle calls upon us to affirm and promote the acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. It is my hope for each of you that wherever you are in your path today, it will keep leading you to an ever deeper journey of the Spirit. On that note, let's sing together our closing hymn, Earth Was Given as a Garden. It's number 207.